Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
From the Missouri School of Journalism, welcome to Global Journalist. I'm David Reed. A new president is about to take power in Mexico amid a raging drug war. The biggest question facing Enrique Peña Nieto is this: what will the federal government do to curtail the gangland violence? Roughly 50,000 people have been killed in drug-related violence since 2006, when President Felipe Calderón launched a military-led crackdown on the drug cartels. The dead include gang members, security forces, police, bystanders, and increasingly journalists. Our guests today include Dudley Althaus, the Mexico City Bureau Chief for the Houston Chronicle. Althaus has written extensively on drug-related violence and its impact on society, and he's been covering Mexico for about 24 years. Welcome to Global Journalist, Dudley.
Hi, good morning.
Also joining us is Tracy Wilkinson. She's the Mexico City Bureau Chief for the Los Angeles Times, where she's worked since 1987. So, Nieto's election by a narrow margin marks the return of the Institutional Revolutionary Party. The PRI lost the presidency 12 years ago after ruling Mexico for about 70 years. Nieto promised in his victory speech that his federal government will continue fighting the drug cartels. But many people have expressed fear that that PRI will return to the way it operated before 2000 and cut cozy deals with drug cartels. But Dudley, the crackdown by Calderón backfired, so would it be such a bad thing to cut deal with the cartels?
Well, I think a lot of Mexicans would like for the violence to slow down and settle down, and in that respect, it wouldn't be a bad thing. The problem is that those kind of deals in the past, this kind of cozy relationships, if you will, kind of laid the groundwork for what we're experiencing now. Calderón, when he launched his offensive, I think they didn't have it well planned out. And it's been a mess, but really the situation was caused by decades of corruption and going along with gangsters that once Calderón unleashed the military against the gangsters, everything just kind of crumbled more than anybody expected it to.
Right. Now, most of the marijuana, cocaine, and heroin consumed here comes through Mexico. An estimated 80% of the drugs trafficked in Mexico end up in the U.S. market, and about 80% of the guns used by the cartels are brought in from the United States, according to estimates. So, Tracy, why should Mexicans lose their lives for the drug habits of people living across the border in the United States?
Well, that's a good question. It's something a lot of Mexicans are asking as well, but I think the thing to keep in mind is that the presence of these cartels operating virtually with impunity here in Mexico also has a corrosive effect on Mexican society, on good governance, on, you know, police forces that are repeatedly corrupt by the cartels. And there's also a growing drug consumption problem in Mexico. So, yes, the U.S. shares a huge part of the blame in the entire equation, but increasingly, you know, Mexico also is suffering, and so that's why Mexicans should care about it.
And Dudley, would you have anything to add on the reason Mexicans should make this a top priority?
Well, yeah, I think the drug thing. I mean, drugs are obviously the impetus for this, and the huge market in the United States. And in the past 5, 6 years or 10 years. Mexico's own drug consumption has grown quite a bit, and actually a lot of the violence in places like Ciudad Juarez and in Monterrey are about local drug markets, about, you know, retail drug sales on the streets, and they're killing kids that are selling stuff for one gang. The other gang comes and shoots them down. You get 16-year-old kids being gunned down in, like, neighborhood stores and that sort of thing. I think more than that, I think that the real issue at play here is who controls Mexico, who controls Mexico at the local level, who controls the rule of law. And I think that's what's at play. People have to talk about drugs being behind all this and the gangsters, because that's what sells to the public. And you've seen Calderon during recent years. I mean, one week he'll lambast the United States for being the major drug market. The next week he'll tell people that actually the war is about their own neighborhoods, their own schools, their own children being threatened by the drug trade. So, I mean, it really plays both ways. But at the heart of all this is the corruption and the governability of the country that is at play.
And let's I imagine that when these killings are escalating and you talk to your international desks and you say we need to write more about the drug wars, and do they sometimes say, well, you know, we've written a lot about that. Why should U.S. readers care about what's happening in Mexico? Tracy, how do you respond to that?
I don't really hear that. I think both Dudley and I work for papers who have a big audience that is on the border and looks to Mexico as, you know, the closest neighbor, with many economic, social, cultural ties. And so I think the interest is still quite high in our newspapers. Any limitation comes from other, you know, financial limitations,
right,
those kinds of things. But I think the interest is there. We in Dudley's paper as well, I mean, we've been very focused on what happened there for a long time. So I don't think that's a problem. I think the problem is getting American readers to pay attention and to, you know, understand what's happening and not to have knee-jerk reactions about, I don't know about Dudley, but a lot of the mail I get is, well, oh, let's just build the wall higher and, you know, keep the Mexicans out, which obviously does not solve the problem. So I think that's there's where you need some education from
right.
The readership. But I think our papers are pretty supportive of covering this, covering this war. I mean, it's on the border. It is affecting communities in Texas, in California, all along the border. So I think in terms of our paper, pretty supportive of coverage.
So let's, Dudley, do you agree about the Chronicle, and also how do you respond when people
well, yes,
give that
I
attitude
I mean,
they don't, shouldn't
there,
care?
There is a lot of interest, obviously, in what's going on, especially as it relates to the Texas border. At my paper, we don't go too far beyond the Texas border, but a lot of the violence has been on the Texas border. I think that there has been, my paper runs hot and cold, frustratingly so sometimes, but the bar has risen dramatically about what violence is worth a story. You know, when I first started here, I mean, one of my first big stories as a journalist was a massacre of seven people in a gangland killing on the border in Matamoros, Mexico. And, I mean, that was national news in both countries for days, for more than a week. Here, you have massacres, and it's just, I don't even think we pick it up. We often get accused by the Mexican government and some Mexicans of hyping the news here, hyping the violence to sell newspapers and that sort of thing. And I've lately argued with people that it's exactly the opposite. I can't get the massacres into the paper. There's no interest. I think we're interested in the backgrounds of it. We've all been writing about it quite a bit. And so I think that there is, you know, readers definitely, I agree with Tracy. I mean, the comments at the bottom of the stories are just outrageous sometimes about building the border and the hell with them all. And people try to, like, put blinders on in the United States about our society's own culpability in this. It's not total culpability. It's not all our fault. It's not all the U.S. public's fault. But the guns come from the United States, if not 80%, then a lot of them. And a lot of the drugs are headed for U.S. consumers.
I'd like to get into the U.S. Involvement, but first, Dudley, can you kind of hit some of the highlights of the history of this drug war escalation?
Yeah, I mean, I've covered Mexico for a long time, and gangsters and narcotics have always been a big part of the beat. but it really kicked into high gear. It started in 2004, 2005 with a contest between the Sinaloa cartel and the so-called Gulf cartel, which is based along the South Texas border, for control of Nuevo Laredo, which is the largest land port for trade between the United States and Mexico. There was extreme violence there in 2004, 2005, where we saw like armed, almost paramilitary groups fighting each other with rocket-propelled grenades and that sort of thing. Vicente Fox sent in the federal police and some army troops, but really didn't concentrate too heavily on it. The situation calmed down in about 2005 and moved elsewhere. When Calderon came into office in 2006, December 2006, having won his election, a disputed election,
right,
opponent claimed fraud, but by very, very few votes. And so when he came into office, he launched, for whatever reason, he launched the army against gangsters in his home state of Michoacan, which is west of Mexico City in the center western part of the state, of the country. I think Calderon expected at that time that his offensive was going to last 3 weeks, a month. It was going to be a very limited operation that was going to calm things down in his home state. It just kind of everything crumbled after that. And all of a sudden you had breakouts between gangs everywhere that drugs moved through Mexico, and the body count just rose. I mean, it's easy to call this is often called Calderon's War. And it's often described as a war between the government and the gangsters, but actually it's a multi-sided war between various gangs, killing one another, and the government stepping in every so often. The federal security forces or the local security forces stepping in and fighting on all sides as well. So it's been a really confusing and multi-sided war that has tended to move in different parts of the country,
right,
every other month.
And it's also, it seems to be more militarized. I think, didn't the Sinaloan cartel hire a group of former Special Forces military personnel to the Zetas, I think they're called?
The Gulf cartel.
And the Gulf cartel. A lot of the violence right now is because the Gulf cartel and the Zetas, who are their former enforcers, their former assassins, had a falling out 2.5 years ago. Internal feuding, and now a lot of the violence, whether it's in Monterrey and the rest of northeastern Mexico, is between those two groups who used to be allies. And now the Sinaloa cartel, which used to fight the Gulf cartel, is now allied with the Gulf cartel against the Zetas in some parts. It gets very confusing. It's like a kaleidoscope, and the only constant is the bloodshed.
And it's extreme, isn't it? I mean, can you maybe describe one of these massacres and the type of military equipment that's used? I don't know. There's RPGs and hand grenades, military tactics.
In many cases, right? Rocket propelled.
Yeah, Tracy. Well, could you kind of give people an idea of how violent these are?
Well, on one level, yes, there's that kind of violence of rocket propelled grenades and even car bombs. More recently, a lot of grenades apparently left over from the wars in Central America that have been used. One of the most notorious incidents was on Independence Day in Michoacan against Calderon's home state on this sacred holiday, essentially, in which they threw grenades into the plaza where people were celebrating the holiday. And I think there were, if I remember correctly, 8 or so. And that was such a direct affront to the government and in ways society. There's that. On another very crude level, there's a brutality and even depravity that is shocking, in which, bodies are dismembered, strung from highway overpasses. Those are not sophisticated military tactics. That's base crude violence. It's designed to both intimidate the enemy and, send a very terrible message out. So on those two levels, you've got this escalation that has been so frightening. One part of the strategy that Dudley was talking about of his government was to go after the leaders, which, makes sense. But what happened, and I don't know if they calculated this, is that as you get rid of a head of a group, there is then a power struggle to succeed the head of that group, and so that has unleashed more and more violence at, you know, lower levels, and has just compounded and compounded the killing and the bloodshed.
Therese, let's talk about the targeting of journalists who dare to write about their attacks. Mexico continues to be the most dangerous place for reporters in Latin America. More than 50 journalists have been killed since 2006, since the crackdown by Calderon. In just one 30-day period this spring, five Mexican journalists were killed. The assaults, abductions, and threats against journalists have continued since the July 1st election. And earlier this week, a group of international press freedom organizations called on the president-elect to make the rights and safety of journalists a priority in his new administration. What's it been like for journalists in Mexico, and is it getting worse?
For Mexican journalists, very difficult, particularly out in the state, in the provinces. They are, of course, living in communities where the drug traffickers may hold sway, corrupt governments hold sway, whether it's at a city level or the state level, and they're under enormous pressure. And so many have been killed, kidnapped, disappeared for either writing about what's happening, or in some cases, it must be said, for being involved in one way or another. Veracruz has been the most recent focal point where you've had, I think, 5, 6, 7, 8 journalists killed or missing in the last couple of months. And there you had a situation where, frankly, some journalists had been cooperating with coverage of one of the cartels that had been in charge for many years, either through threat, coercion, bribery, whatever. Another cartel moves in to start to fight that cartel, and so journalists also become victims. Other cases are where journalists have very honestly tried to cover what's happening, and that doesn't behoove anybody, either the cartel or, in some cases, the government itself. I've asked Mexican journalists, you know, where does the bigger threat come from, the cartel or the local government? And you know, they often say, well, what's the difference? And then the next response is, well, you know, it's kind of, you don't know where the threat is coming from. These journalists, Mexican journalists, are exposed to kinds of pressures that we as foreign journalists really can't imagine, where a governor can call your editor and get you fired, or where the local drug gang in charge, you know, knows where you live, knows where your children go to school. It's an unimaginable kind of threat that obviously forces them to either pull their punches, not cover what's happening, or cover things in the way they're ordered to cover it. And that's been the situation. As bad as the killings are, and that's terrible, it's also the self-censorship is really a very chilling development, because it means journalists are not doing their jobs, they're not able to do their jobs, they're not able to do the public service of reporting, telling readers what's happening.
I remember in 2010, the Mexican daily newspaper came out with one of the biggest newspapers in Mexico came out with a front page open letter to the cartels. Zelda, can you explain what happened then? And
yeah, that was a newspaper in Ciudad Juarez, El Diario. It's not one of the biggest papers in Mexico, but it was definitely on the front lines, and we're doing some pretty brave reporting. Where other border newspapers have really shut down and not reporting, but they put out an editorial, front page editorial, following the killing of one of their journalists. Is, what do you want from us? What do you want us to do? Which is just basically capitulation, but I think it was also intended to call the bluff on things. Diario has kept reporting pretty aggressively on the drug war violence, which has calmed down considerably in Juarez, by the way, in the past year. But I think that was a really a wake-up call for the press. But it had been going on for quite a while. You know, the newspaper in Nuevo Laredo stopped reporting on the violence a long time ago, and they've still had attacks this year in the past month or so on their offices in Nuevo Laredo, and they came out again and said, we're not reporting on the drug violence. We're not going to touch it, basically just pleading to be left alone. In smaller communities, I mean, it makes sense because most people in these towns know who's doing what to whom, pretty much. A lot of it's rumor. Maybe it's not totally confirmed, but pretty much. And the newspaper comes out the day later and says what happened yesterday, and you name names or you touch somebody's business operations, and you're putting yourself at risk. Nobody has any protection against these guys. If they want to kill you, they'll kill you. So for newspapers to shut down makes some sense for, you know, I don't know what I would do in that situation. I used to be an editor of a small border newspaper. But certainly it's had a chilling effect.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And we don't know, us here in Mexico City, or if we're traveling around the country, we rely more and more on, you know, on looking at social media and Twitter, on text messages or Facebook or whatever, to kind of get a feel of what's going on in some of these border communities or smaller communities in the outback, if you will. And none of that stuff can be confirmed. It gets very dicey. And
right.
There's been a lot of misinformation put out there in the social media as well. So it gets very dicey as far as trying to report accurately about what's going on.
So in a way, the efforts to silence journalists has succeeded by the drug cartels in a way?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, absolutely.
Yeah, so, definitely.
Now, before we continue our discussion, I want to remind everyone that you can view or listen to this program anytime by downloading our podcasts at globaljournalist.org. You can also find interesting articles, photos, and interviews related to our program on our website. So please send us questions or comments via globaljournalist@kbia.org or our Facebook page. You can also follow us on Twitter at GJJournalist. Now, can we move to what do we do? And I know, Dudley, for instance, we've got a new U.S. General Counsel in Nuevo Laredo, Vice Admiral?
The Consul General in Nuevo Laredo is a guy who he last worked on the he worked previously on the National Security Council for Anti-Terrorism. I think it was significant that they've posted him there.
Yeah, why is that?
The Admiral that you're talking about is the new military attaché here. He's a Navy SEAL Admiral, Navy Special Forces Admiral.
So what are the significance of those two moves?
I think the significance is that Washington is very concerned about, especially northeastern Mexico, the corridor and the Zetas, the paramilitary gangsters up on the base out of the northeastern corridor and on the Texas border. What it means operationally, I'm not really sure. And I guess we'll have to wait and see, but I think it displays a level of concern and a level of perhaps signals what Washington's thinking about as far as a response to it.
Where do you see this going, Dudley? You mentioned that in Juarez it's calming down. Do you think these drug cartels are wearing themselves out, or what do you think's going to happen in the coming months?
You know, I think that's speculation, but I think the drug cartels have realized. I mean, they're down now. You have a situation where they're capturing supposed Zeta bosses, local Zeta bosses in southeastern Mexico, in Veracruz, Tabasco. And around the Monterrey area up in the north towards the U.S. border, but these guys don't have much experience. It's like the Zetas are kind of running through there, anybody that's qualified to run anything, and they're getting these guys captured. The Navy recently captured a guy that claimed was the Zetas boss in a major city in the southeast who was 18 years old. I think that shows a level of wearing out of some of the gangs. I think in Juarez, the situation is, it's unclear. There's still debate about it, but I think it was intense pressure on the part of the government, and these two different alliances of gangs up there have been killing each other for quite a while. You have 10,000 deaths up there. And at a certain point, it becomes in everybody's interest to let things calm down, which might well play into what people suspect. A lot of people either criticize or suspect Peña Nieto for thinking about the incoming president about trying to negotiate some sort of peace.
Right.
I think it might be in everybody's interest to calm things down a bit.
Let's talk just briefly about the demand side. Tracy, are there increasing talks about legalization, particularly of marijuana, being something that would help calm down the drug war?
Well, that is talked about increasingly, including several leaders in the region have talked about introducing it into the debate, at least. Peña Nieto has said that while he doesn't personally favor legalization, he's interested in hearing the debate talking about it, which is actually the same position that Calderon had. And I know there's a lot of pressure in the United States for that to be a major element in sort of shifting the drug war. My concern about that is that, you know, these cartels are now into so many other things beyond the production and moving of drugs. I mean, that's still their bread and butter, if you will, but they're also, you know, into contraband, into piracy, into moving human beings, you know, the trafficking of human beings, et cetera. So that I think even if you were to remove that one element, component of their financial structure, they have so many other illicit activities going on that I'm not sure it would necessarily solve the question of violence. So, yes, it's something that's certainly being talked about, but I don't know that it would necessarily solve the problem.
Dudley, we're starting to run out of time, but do you have anything briefly to add on that topic?
Well, I think Tracy's absolutely right. I mean, it's not going to, that's not going to be the savior in Mexico, legalizing marijuana in the United States. Whether they should do it or not, I'm agnostic about that, but it's not going to come in time to, it's not going to come in time to solve this situation. That's a red herring. And the problem with Peña Nieto has said he wants to concentrate on crimes that most affect Mexican citizens, murder, kidnapping, extortion. Those are all state crimes. Calderon said the same thing. A lot of the problem has been a lack of cooperation or ability at the state levels. A lot of them are controlled by Peña Nieto's own party, but not totally controlled by his party.
Right.
They've just not been able to do that. And that, what Peña Nieto does, what new ammunition he brings to the table, I'm not really sure. I think that the situation is going to continue pretty much the way it is, at least for a while, but we'll have to see.
Well, we'll leave it off at there. We've come to the end of this week's edition of Global Journalist, produced by the Reynolds Journalism Institute and the Missouri School of Journalism. Our program is directed by Travis McMillan, audio by Pat Akers. Raymond Tungankar is our executive producer. Gina Cook was our lead producer. Now stay with us for Free Press Watch, and join us again next week for another Global Journalist. I'm David Reed.
And now, Free Press Watch, a segment on Global Journalist, where each week we bring you a rundown of major events affecting press freedom around the world. I'm Regina Wong. Today's news comes from the Associated Press, CNN, and International Press Institute. In Mexico, two newspapers were assaulted numerous times in July because of their coverage on drug cartels. El Norte, one of the best-known newspapers in Mexico, was attacked for the third time in less than a month. Several masked men spread gasoline and lit fire to the newspaper's Monterrey office on July 29th, less than 3 weeks after its two other offices were damaged by grenades and gunfire from AK-47 rifles. Another newspaper, El Mañana, received grenade attacks on July 10th and 11th. No one was injured in any of these incidents. Since 2000, more than 70 journalists have been killed in Mexico. For more information on these and other events affecting press freedom around the world, please visit our website at globaljournalist.org. Thank you for joining us this week. I'm Regina Wong. See you next week.